that Israel is not our friend. Israel will never be will never be our friend. And what we need at this moment is to see the freedom of the Palestinian people and the establishment of the Palestinian state away from Israeli mechanisms of violence.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last September said African migrants constitute a real threat to Israel's character and future as a Jewish state. His remarks came after at least 140 Eritrean asylum seekers were injured in Tel Aviv. Such statements have created an awakening in Africa on the racist nature of the evil Israeli regime.
I think it was a very significant statement because the Israeli mask is now falling apart, where a sitting prime minister can actively make such a xenophobic statement. But again, once we go from and understand the epistemologies of Israeli violence, we will see the forced sterilization of Ethiopian Jews who were immigrating to Israel. We will see the mechanisms of racism Black Israeli settlers are facing within Israel. So it's not something that shocked the world. It's something that made the world aware that Israel, number one, is a xenophobic state. Israel, number two, is a racist.
Despite the escape of Israeli regime officials from Rabat, Moroccans continue their protests until normalization with Tel Aviv is revoked. A Moroccan speaks here during a protest to condemn the Israeli regime's deadly airstrike that targeted a hospital in Gaza.
المفروض أنه بعيد كل البعد على أي أعمال حربية هذه الجريمة يتحمل مسؤوليتها أولا كيان الصهيوني المجرم وهو دليل على أنه ليس بدولة وإنما هو عصابة إجرامية وإلى زوال تتحمل مسؤوليتها أمريكا والدول الغربية التي تغطي على هذه الجرائم.
The people of Morocco are clearly diametrically opposed to the country's monarchy that has normalized ties with the Israeli regime. How will the Israeli genocide against the people of Palestine impact on the infamous normalization project with countries such as Morocco?
This form of being in solidarity with Palestine has in essence given many of us within African countries a voice, because the right to protest is always being minimized within the states, where there's police violence. In any time there's any freedom of expression, there's freedom of protesting and demonstration. So it's a mechanism where we have to align ourselves and make sure that this is not just a fight for our voices to be heard. It's a fight for human rights. It's a fight for democracy on all fronts. So while I do know that the Moroccan government is really fighting for the normalization tactics, the people of Africa will reject it. And at this point, the people are the ones who have the majority of voice. Where if we continue allying together, and the Palestinian cause is bringing us together, we're seeing a rise in Pan-Africanism because of this. We're seeing a rise in transnational solidarities because of this. So the Palestinian cause is literally something that is bringing the African people together to say no to a colonizing power. So even with Morocco, the establishment of normalization will fall apart.
The African Union strongly condemned the Israeli regime's inhuman airstrike on Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza, which killed more than 500 people. As Ms. Barasa said, the people of Africa are saying condemnation is not enough and now want their countries to cut ties with the Israeli regime. Ms. Barasa, you have the last word. Now, what is hindering action by African governments towards cutting ties with the Israeli apartheid regime?
Historically, the African people have relied on their governments. And unfortunately, these governments, instead of listening to the people, they listen more to and prioritize the voice of diplomatic, their development partners, and the voices of other countries, which for us does not work so well for us. And so our mobilization in the Global South in Africa is to basically create a formidable voice that can, number one, organize people and mobilize us to ensure that our voices can be heard by our governments, and that our governments can take our intentions and these intentions influence foreign policies especially, but also our governments recognize that we are their voters, and therefore they go by our aspirations. And our aspirations as the African people are definitely deep-rooted into our deep history of colonialization. And so this must influence how our foreign policy is conceived.
Well, there you have it. African people stand with Palestine, and the governments in the continent need to be in tandem with the aspirations of the people that voted for them. Well, and that brings us to the end of yet another episode of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
Britain's prison population has been steadily rising since 2020, and there are now 87,793 inmates locked up. As of 29th of September, capacity across the whole estate stood at 88,561. The British government estimates these figures will only get worse, with a prison population expected to increase to between 93,000 and 106,000 by March of 2027. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Criminals may be released from jail early or not locked up in the first place, as figures uncovered recently show overcrowding in UK prisons to nearly breaking point. New statistics reveal the majority of prisons are now dangerously full, with some, including Wandsworth, where former soldier Daniel Khalifa is accused of escaping, holding 70% more inmates than they should. The shortfall prompted warnings from the Chief of Prison Governors, former Home Secretary Jack Straw, and former Tory Prisons Minister Rory Stewart, who all warned that early release may have to be considered to tackle the crisis. Talk of drastic measure comes as latest figures show nearly two-thirds of jails in England are officially overcrowded, with just 768 free spaces within the entire prison state. A prison union threatened to take legal action if the Ministry of Justice asked governors to find extra capacity in already packed prisons. And His Majesty's Inspector of Prisons said prisons were already being asked to double up in cells to avert crisis. Experts warned of the longer-term problem of accommodating prisoners even if short-term fixes are found. The prison governor's chief warned the nuclear button could be pressed very soon as the system runs dangerously close to capacity. Andrea Olbutt, president of the Prisoners' Governors Association, said it was common sense that the government would have to consider an early release scheme for thousands of prisoners, adding, "The fact is we are overcrowded to the nth degree and there is no capacity left. Once we are full, we are full." She added, "We are reaching the critical point, the point of no return. In the adult male estate, there are only a few hundred spaces left, and that will be consumed within the next couple of weeks." Jack Straw, who as Labour's Justice Secretary oversaw an early release scheme for prisoners, said although he was not updated on the current state of prisons, the government was facing a perfect storm arising from the willful neglect of the whole criminal justice system over the past 13 years. Discussing early release, Jack Straw went on, "The government would find that very uncomfortable, but they may have to do it." He added, "Rishi Sunak, Suella Braverman and Alex Chalk need to realise the state of the crisis and that the government is failing in one of its fundamental duties to keep people safe." And Stewart said those in power should have the courage to abolish short prison sentences for minor offenders in a bid to tackle the issue. Stewart added, "The only way of addressing this is for a political party to have the courage to reduce the prison population. They will never be able to build enough prisons to keep up. Let's abolish short sentences in prison for minor offences and let's reduce the length of sentences. We should be learning from Europe, not the United States, and locking up fewer people." Britain's prison population has been steadily rising since 2020, and there are now 87,793 inmates locked up in British prisons. As of 29th of September, capacity across the whole estate stood at 88,561. According to August statistics from the Ministry of Justice, His Majesty's prison at Wandsworth is at 170% occupancy. His Majesty's prison at Leeds is currently at 172% occupancy, and His Majesty's prison at Durham is at 171%. The government estimates these figures will only get worse, with the prison population expected to increase to between 93,000 and 106,000 by March of 2027. Justice Committee Chair Sir Bob Neill has warned that even if the new prisons in the pipeline are completed on time, there would still be a shortfall in March of 2025 of 2,300 places. His Majesty's Inspector of Prisons, Charlie Taylor, warned prisons may hit a crisis point in the next 6 months to a year, but said that temporary measures such as using police cells under a scheme known as Operation Safeguard could alleviate the situation. However, he expressed concern that this will eventually come to a head as the prison population grows. Police cells have been used to house prisoners 871 times between February, when the scheme started, and June. Charlie Taylor said, "In the longer term, there's a much more protracted problem where we won't be able to accommodate people anymore. You've got three choices. You either build a bigger bath, let some of the water out of the bath, or turn off the taps." He added, "Overcrowding affects everything. It means prisoners spend longer locked up. There's more pressure on showers, pressure on getting out for exercise, rising levels of violence. A prison is classified as overcrowded if the number of prisoners held exceeds the Certified Normal Accommodation, or CNA. The Certified Normal Accommodation is set by the prison service and is the number of spots available for prisoners under a decent standard of accommodation. The operational capacity is the absolute maximum number of prisoners that could fit into the prison. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. A recent analysis shows that 78 out of the 124 jails in England and Wales have a population greater than the number of Certified Normal Accommodation or CNA spaces. Britain's Ministry of Justice has claimed it is taking measures to reduce the demand pressures on the system, including increasing within safe limits the number of prisoners held in the existing estate and bringing non-critical maintenance cells back online. All non-critical maintenance work has also been paused. The department has also expanded the home detention curfew scheme, allowing prisoners to be released from jail earlier under conditions such as tagging. Internal analysis from May found this would free up to 300 prison spaces. Magistrates have also been told to have an awareness of the impact of the current prison population levels when issuing sentences. Andrea Allbutt, president of the Prison Governors Association, said the situation was making work very dangerous for governors. She added, "If the government further overcrowded our prisons, if they say to our members, you will put more people in your already overcrowded prison, we will take legal action." Labour MP Andy Slaughter, who has His Majesty's prison at Wormwood Scrubs in his constituency, has written to the Justice Secretary to share his concerns about the underlying problems of staffing and overcrowding in prisons. Andy Slaughter added, "The overcrowding could actually be worse than is realised."
Dow Chemical and DuPont are American chemical corporations. These two chemical giants have become the number one companies in the chemical sector. Today, they make billions of euros in profit. But behind this resounding success lies a dark secret: toxic contamination and pollution, which has affected thousands, causing disabilities, cancers, and even death. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For decades, Dow Chemical and DuPont factories have been secretly dumping their toxic waste into rivers, groundwater systems, and soil, and keeping the tragic consequences a secret. Sadly, the constant exposure to toxic waste spares no one, neither surrounding residents nor the company's employees. Stay with us as this week's documentary sheds light over years of lies and impunity through the analysis of samples in confidential documents.
At the end of the 60s, Leotis Jones was a prisoner in Holmesburg, a suburb of Philadelphia in the United States. A prisoner, but also a guinea pig for industry, like thousands of other inmates.
H-block, this is where all the medical testing, the human experimentation was going on.
How many times have you taken that corridor?
Oh, man, about maybe 25, 30 times. You know, but there was different tests that they was running. And sometimes I was on like two tests at a time, you know?
Okay.
This practice was confidential at the time, because multinational chemical companies came here to test the risks of their products. To earn a few dollars, the prisoners participated in several tests, but none of them knew what they were being given.
What they would do, they would put the tape and stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it. Then they would put a drop in the substance, whatever it was that was in it, on that area.
And what happened after?
All over my body, my skin pigmentation got light in certain areas.
How long did it last?
About a year, somewhere around there. And they had you signing a paper stating that it was informed consent, but it was just a paper to waive them from being liable if anything go wrong.
One company did everything they could to keep this a secret. They even paid Leotis Jones for his silence. Dow Chemical. The leading manufacturer of plastics in the world and the third largest manufacturer of pesticides, Dow Chemical has an annual turnover of $48 billion and 50,000 employees around the globe. In the wake of this chemical giant, there's an industry of staggering profitability. An industry in a frantic race to innovate. Each year, their new toxic products reach the market. These multinationals all have one thing in common, a culture of secrecy.
You're following us.
Polluting lands, rivers, and groundwater. Behind the fumes of these factories, we have discovered tens of thousands of victims. In India, children are born with severe disabilities. In the U.S., those who have dedicated their lives to this industry...
Everybody wanted to go there because of, for the money, for the benefits, and it was secure.
...are now paying the price.
Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. Why'd they lie?
Faced with these tragedies, the chemical giants have adopted a specific course of action. Lack of transparency... Cynicism, denial. In the meantime, they continue to reap the profits. In Holmesburg Prison, Dow experimented on the inmates with one of the most carcinogenic products in the world, dioxin. It's one of the molecules in Agent Orange, the powerful herbicide that Dow produced for the American Army during the Vietnam War. The Air Force dumped it on the Viet Cong for a decade. At the same time, the tests were being performed at Holmesburg. From that time on, Dow was already aware of the dangers of dioxin. The company put it in writing in this confidential note from June 1965. Dioxin is exceptionally toxic. Some months later, Dow would study its side effects on the prisoners.
Hey, man, what can I say? There's no way in the world if they would have informed us back then that we would participate. No. No, no, I wouldn't have. They were trying to cover it up. They wouldn't have made it up.
We found one of the doctors that performed the tests at Holmesburg in the 1960s. Today, he's an oncologist at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago. Sigmund Weitzman is preparing to retire. He is one of the few witnesses still alive.
Every day, I had a row of 20 convicts. They were coming in all day. Okay. So
all day long, people were coming in?
Oh, absolutely. It was a machine.
In 1967, Sigmund Weitzman was only 21 years old. He was an intern at Holmesburg. The senior physician overseeing the tests never told him the names of the products used on the prisoners. He only realized later that he had administered dioxin to human beings. We show him what Dow knew back then about the chemical.
This material is exceptionally toxic. No wonder it's confidential. This is 50 years old.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting.
This is the first time you read these documents?
Yes.
I'm
appalled. I'm just very... It's so casual. I also felt personally guilty that I was participating in something so horrible. You don't give people poison. It's just simple. You know, as if these people aren't people. They're just experimental animals. Nowadays, it would be criminal.
Dow was never prosecuted. When prisoners tried to take action against the company, the statute of limitations had expired. This multinational would not only poison inmates with dioxin, but also tens of thousands of people in Midland, Michigan, in the north of the U.S. Midland, the birthplace of Dow.
Here at the Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan, revolutionary chemical killers.
This is where Agent Orange was manufactured. Its production created waste extremely high in dioxin. Dow secretly dumped this waste into the river that flows through the city. In 1981, one man would discover the truth.
We had a conclusion there that Dow was a major source, if not the only source, to the river, and certainly to the community, and that people were at risk.
At the time, Milton Clark was a toxicologist for the EPA, the government agency responsible for environmental protection. With his colleagues, he wrote a report condemning Dow's practices. But right before the report's publication, the corporation would succeed in pressuring the acting chief of the EPA in Washington. Pressured by his superiors, Milton Clark was forced to censor the report. The result? Pollution in Midland, Michigan would continue for 30 years with impunity. And the executives at Dow would continue denying the dangers.
There is no health problem in Midland. There is absolutely no evidence of dioxin doing any damage to humans.
In 2006, one woman would attack the multinational again. At the time, Mary Gade oversaw all the offices at the Environmental Agency in the Midland region. She had leverage. She'd been nominated by the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Newly appointed, she demands that more testing be done in the city.
We found these astronomically high levels of dioxin, levels that my staff think may be some of the highest levels ever found in the United States. One of the things that was astonishing to me when this came to my attention was that for almost 30 years, this very serious problem had not actually been addressed.
Where have you found these high levels?
So yeah, we found that in yards alongside the river system, parks where children play, where people launch their boats, where fishermen put their boats in the water. This is where people live. So I immediately called Dow senior officials and said, we're very concerned about these levels. We need you to take action. As that unfolded, the company was not happy. It's extremely expensive to clean up this much contamination, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more.
To lodge a complaint, Dow goes directly to the White House.
I was asked on May 1st of 2008 to either resign or quit by the end of the day.
Okay. Were you surprised?
Yes, very much so. In my 30-some years of working in environmental protection and much of that spent in the government, I would have never expected that. Dow was acting in its own interests, so Dow was trying to make sure that it saved as much money as possible.
As a result of these maneuvers, for decades, thousands of people have lived surrounded by dioxin without knowing the risks. We wanted to meet these victims. But in Midland, it's hard to loosen tongues. Dow has supported the city for 120 years. And reminders are at every corner. At the bank, the stadium, the library, the public park, the high school. The shadow of the company is everywhere. Only one person agreed to break the code of silence. Alice Buchelter has spent most of her life here, near the river. This is where she raised her family.
We used to have all trails that went down through here. The land is very fertile, and it was used for motocross trails and hiking trails and dune buggy trails and just, you know, recreation in the woods. For a kid, it was like a wonderland. It was, you know, an adventure. They could explore and they could build forts and they could do all those things.
No one advised you that there was dioxin down there?
Nope. We just thought we found a magical spot for us to play and raise a family.
For nearly 40 years, the Buchelter family would live here, blissfully unaware of their toxic surroundings. Every spring, the river floods their garden, bringing in a fresh wave of dioxin. Alice Buchelter would not discover the true extent of the contamination until 2007, when tests were conducted in her garden by the local environmental agency. The levels of dioxin were up to 17 times higher than the legal limit for toxicity.
My oldest daughter has autoimmune diseases.
You have five kids?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them do have autoimmune disease?
I would say all of them. Some to a lesser degree and some to a more severe degree. And my husband had a very malignant colon cancer. It was a real quick onset.
Her late husband, Herbert Buchelter, was a doctor. A few days before he passed away, he expressed a last wish.
He was brave enough to, when he was dying, to have his blood drawn when he didn't have very much blood left. Dioxin levels were taken the Thursday before he died on a Sunday. He was willing to do it to ascertain that there was a connection. The results of my husband's. This is his levels.
These are the actual breakdown.
Alex Buchelter's husband had 64.5 nanograms of dioxin per liter of blood, three times the U.S. average.
We had been married 46 years when he died. And and would I have treasured 10 more years? Yeah. And, you know, that's been a major impact on my life.
The American Environmental Agency has finally forced Dow to clean the river. But the process has only just begun. It could take decades and cost hundreds of millions of dollars. However, no date is set for decontaminating neighboring yards like Alice Buchelter's. Dow refused all our requests for an interview. The multinational merely sent us an email stating that we seek science-based solutions that protect human health while also contributing to the well-being of the local community. On the other side of the world, another contamination is wreaking havoc. As a result of one of the worst industrial catastrophes in history, thousands of children have been affected. But Dow has never dealt with it. It happened in India, in Bhopal. In 1984, the local chemical plant exploded, killing 20,000 people and releasing tons of toxic products. At the time, the factory belonged to Union Carbide, a pesticide giant that Dow would buy up in 2001. The site of the Bhopal explosion is still saturated with chemical pollution. Over the years, these products have spread into the city's groundwater systems. For 15 years, the inhabitants have demanded a full decontamination. In vain, Dow refuses to act. The decaying steel site is still accessible today. Here we meet Mr. Xuan, a former engineer. At the time, he was in charge of the storage of the chemicals in this laboratory.
There's so many chemicals still remaining in this quality control lab. Very few bottles are now at present. But after the disaster, this quality control lab was full of the chemicals, bottle, drums. And after 32 years, still they are lying.
Is that dangerous?
Yeah, it is dangerous because there's no proper care of these premises.
Among the products stored in the factory, there was lindane, an extremely toxic insecticide. Today it is forbidden all over the world. According to our guide, the soil surrounding the factory is full of it.
The whole area is highly contaminated. They are dumping all toxic waste effluent on the ground. Right now you can feel the smell of the benzene hexachloride on this spot. And it is dangerous to stay here for a long period.
Benzene hexachloride is the scientific name for lindane. We go down to the area of the spill to take some samples. The smell is unbearable. We'll have the soil analyzed. Just before leaving, Mr. Xuan shows us where the pesticides were made. Beads of mercury lie exposed in the open air. According to the World Health Organization, this is one of the top 10 most dangerous chemical products in the world. We take some more samples. The results of our two tests are astonishing. Inside the factory, the level of mercury is 5 million times higher than the environmental standard. At this level of concentration, the risks of developing liver, skin, or lung cancers are considerable. The levels of lindane are just as alarming, exceeding 100,000 times the standard level. This can provoke severe cases of cerebral degeneration. Yet only 20 meters away, we see children playing cricket on the contaminated ground. The chemical contamination stretches far beyond the walls of the factory. Toxic waste has penetrated the land and has polluted the water of many neighborhoods. Up to 3 kilometers from the factory, 50,000 people live there. We went to take water samples to identify the molecules present in their wells. Like in Shakya's family home, they've lived in this house for almost 30 years. The water they consume contains 1.9 micrograms of mercury per liter, 2 times the standard level of toxicity. The problem is, even in boiled water, mercury is still carcinogenic. In other areas of Bhopal, it's not mercury, but lindane that wreaks havoc on human lives. This is a problem in Preetnagar, a neighborhood situated 1 kilometer away from the factory. The municipality has had drinkable water since 2011, but for many years, the inhabitants have been drinking severely polluted water. That's the case for Rukmani and her 13-year-old daughter, Rachna. Since her birth, she's suffered from limited mental development and muscular dystrophy. She can neither talk nor stand up by herself. Rukmani, her mother, drank contaminated water every day during her pregnancy. A few months after Rachna's birth, a governmental study was conducted in the area. The levels of lindane were extremely high in the water, 17 times the World Health Organization limit. Due to her disabilities, Rachna has never been able to go to school. Every day she comes to the Shingari Rehabilitation Center. Without these daily exercises, she would be completely paralyzed today. Rashida B. is the founder of the center. She has watched all these children grow up.
option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
Top United Nations official in New York has stepped down, citing genocide of Palestinian civilians in the besieged Gaza Strip. Craig Mochiber, director of Human Rights Body, has accused the United States, Britain, and much of Europe as being wholly complicit in the horrific assault. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The director of the New York chapter of the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights has resigned, protesting the world body's failure to prevent underway genocide in the Gaza Strip, which has come under a brutal Israeli war. Craig Mochiber submitted his resignation to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, in a letter dated 28th of October. Reactions began to pour in across social media platforms, including X, formerly known as Twitter, on Tuesday, 31st of October. "Once again, we are seeing a genocide unfolding before our eyes, and the organization we serve appears powerless to stop it," Mochiber wrote, referring to the United Nations. Mochiber was referring to the current war that the Israeli regime is waging against the Gaza Strip. The ongoing Israeli massacre has killed more than 8,600 Palestinians and left over 23,000 others wounded in the besieged Gaza Strip. Craig Mochiber cited the United States, Britain, and much of Europe as being wholly complicit in the horrific assault, referring to the Western allies' consistent political and military support for the Israeli regime, which has bubbled up even throughout the war. "This is a textbook case of genocide," Mochiber said. "The European ethno-nationalist settler colonial project in Palestine has entered its final phase, towards the expedited destruction of the last remnants of indigenous Palestinian life in Palestine." The letter went on to call for an end to the Israeli regime's occupation of the Palestinian territories, supporting the establishment of a single democratic state in all of historic Palestine with equal rights for Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic of Iran has condemned in the strongest possible terms the Israeli regime's recent attack against the Jabalia refugee camp in the Gaza Strip that has killed and injured hundreds of Palestinians. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, speaking on Tuesday, 31st of October, said, "This massacre added another black mark on the already long list of the Zionist regime's war crimes. At least 400 Palestinians, mostly women and children, were killed or injured after Israeli airstrikes hit the Jabalia refugee camp amid the regime's ongoing war against the besieged Gaza Strip." Iyad al-Bazoum, spokesman for Gaza's Interior Ministry, said the United States-made bombs had targeted residential homes during the blitz on the Jabalia refugee camp, adding that an entire residential complex has been destroyed in the Israeli attack. "These buildings house hundreds of citizens. The occupation's air force destroyed this district with six US-made bombs. It is the latest massacre caused by the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip, he said. Iyad al-Bazoum called on the international community to act immediately to stop Israel before it's too late. The war has so far killed more than 8,600 Palestinians and left over 23,000 others wounded, according to the Palestinian ministry. The figure excludes the casualties caused by the Israeli attack on the Jabalia refugee camp. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, asked the international community, especially the United Nations and the World Police Security Council, to act promptly on their international duty to stop the apartheid Zionist regime's killing machine. Video footage from the Jabalia refugee camp showed buildings completely leveled to the ground, and panicked Palestinian residents could be seen carrying wounded children away from the scene or searching for survivors. On 7th of October, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas launched its biggest operation against Israel in years in a surprise offensive, dubbed Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, in response to the occupying regime's intensified crimes against the Palestinians. The ongoing Israeli massacre has killed 8,610 Palestinians and left more than 23,000 others wounded. According to the figures provided on Tuesday, 31st of October, by the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza, the figure excludes the casualties from the Israeli attack on the Jabalia refugee camp. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. The director of the New York office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights has left his post protesting that the United Nations is failing in its duty to prevent what he categorized as genocide of Palestinian civilians in Gaza under Israeli bombardment, and citing the United States, Britain, and much of Europe as being wholly complicit in the horrific assault. The director of the New York Office for the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Craig Mukhiba, wrote on 28th of October to the UN High Commissioner in Geneva, Volker Turk, saying, "This will be my last communication to you." Craig Mukhiba, who was stepping down having reached retirement age, wrote, "Once again, we are seeing a genocide unfolding before our eyes, and the organization we serve appears powerless to stop it." He said that the United Nations had failed to prevent previous genocides against the Tutsis in Rwanda, Muslims in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Yazidis in Iraqi Kurdistan, and the Rohingya in Myanmar. He wrote to the High Commissioner, "We are failing yet again. The current wholesale slaughter of the Palestinian people, rooted in an ethno-nationalist colonial settler ideology, in continuation of decades of their systematic persecution and purging, based entirely upon their status as Arabs, leaves no room for doubt." Craig Mukhiba added, "This is a textbook case of genocide." He said the United States, Britain, and much of Europe were not only refusing to meet their treaty obligations under the Geneva Conventions, but were also arming Israel's assault on Gaza and providing political and diplomatic cover for it. Elsewhere in his resignation letter, Craig Mukhiba wrote, "We must support the establishment of a single democratic secular state in all of historic Palestine, with equal rights for Christians, Muslims, and Jews." He added, "And therefore, the dismantling of the deeply racist settler colonial project and an end to apartheid across the land." Craig Mukhiba has worked for the United Nations since 1992, serving in a number of increasingly prominent roles. He led the High Commissioner's work on devising a human rights-based approach to development and acted as a senior human rights advisor in Palestine, Afghanistan, and Sudan. A lawyer who specializes in international human rights law, Craig Mukhiba lived in the Gaza Strip in the 1990s. In his role as director of the New York Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, he has come under occasional fire from pro-Zionist groups for his comments on social media platforms. He was criticized for posting support of the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, the BDS movement, and he was also accused Israel of apartheid, an accusation which he repeated in his retirement letter. Journalists and academics began posting the letter's contents to X, formerly known as Twitter, on Tuesday afternoon, 31st of October. A spokesman for the United Nations in New York sent The Guardian a statement about Craig Mukhiba saying, "I can confirm that he's retiring today." He informed the United Nations in March of 2023 of his upcoming retirement, which takes effect tomorrow. The views in his letter made public today are his personal views. The statement went on to say, "The position of the office on the grave situation in the occupied Palestinian territories and Israel is reflected in our reports and public statements." Reactions to Craig Mukhiba's outspoken departure from such a prominent United Nations position was mixed. Louis Charbonneau, the United Nations Director of Human Rights Watch, told The Guardian, "He had made a powerful argument against double standards in the stance of the world body." Louis Charbonneau, the United Nations Director of Human Rights Watch, said, "You don't have to agree with everything in the letter to see that he's actually made a powerful and depressing case that the United Nations lost its way on human rights when it comes to Israel and Palestine, partly because of pressure from the United States of America, Israel, and various other governments. But it is not too late to turn the United Nations ship around, but they need to do it quickly."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with President Raisi and his cabinet on August 30, 2023, on the occasion of Government Week. In the field of foreign policy, the government's dynamism in its foreign policy is very good. Becoming a member of two important international alliances, that is BRICS and SCO, in a short space of time was a very good achievement, and it is not only beneficial for the country, but it also shows a reality. Countries around the world do not do things without a reason. They don't invite everyone to just come and join. They do this based on the calculations they have made, and they accept a government based on their calculations. These calculations are very important. This shows that Iran is in a position where the members and the founders of these international alliances are interested in and sometimes even insisted on our beloved country's membership in these organizations.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Good things have also been done in the cultural sector, which of course should be increased both in quality and in quantity. And good progress have also been made in various other departments, the details of which you are already aware of. My recommendations to you is that if there are things that the administration has done that can make people happy, then let them know about these things. There is a big gap between the actual realities and what people perceive as realities. What they perceive as facts is genuinely far from reality of the situation. Try to reduce this gap. People should find out more about these realities. This requires work. It is not a simple task or an ordinary smooth progress. This requires work. It is not a simple task or an ordinary smooth process. This kind of work needs to be thought through. It needs expertise, and it requires the help of experts. Now, I would like to remind you of a few things. I have reportedly said that the country's main priorities are the economy and our culture. These are our top two priorities. As for the economy, our slogan has two parts this year. One is about controlling inflation, and the other is about increasing production.
Oh, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Outraged Syrians and Palestinians gathered in their Mook refugee camp in Damascus to support the people of Gaza against the brutal atrocities committed by the Israeli regime.
We have gathered today in Yarmouk camp to send a message of solidarity to our resilient brothers and sisters in Gaza who are bravely paving the way back to Palestine with their blood. We assure them that they are not alone. The Arab peoples, the resistance front, and the free people of the world stand with you.
We will liberate every part of Palestine by God's will. We express our gratitude to Syria and Mr. Bashar al-Assad for supporting us and taking an honorable stance. We tell everyone that our people will not die by the grace of God.
Protesters voiced their anger towards Western powers that have been supporting Israel's war crimes, specifically the recent massacre in the Jabalia refugee camp, which violates all laws, norms, and human ethics.
What happened in Jabalia and previous Israeli massacres provide clear evidence of regional and international collusion.